Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and welcome to Future Proof. Today, we are talking... Actually, I recorded this last week at Collision in Candor. Today is Tuesday, the... what day is it? Like the 8th? Yes, the 8th. And I want to bring you a really great conversation I had with Terry Fong over at NASA. I say it like Nassau County. It's really NASA, as people who are smarter than me say it. He is one of the sharper people that I think you'll ever hear speak, period. He is a whiz with respect to robotics and innovation, and we have a really deep, nerdy chat on all things autonomous, on how to innovate, on how to get a career going at NASA. Hopefully I said that right. So let's cut to the conversation
okay,
now.
So Terry, welcome to Future Proof. Really, really excited to be talking to you. I think I have your title down, but I might get it wrong. Is it senior scientist? I've seen multiple titles listed, but maybe
actually,
at different times.
I currently actually have two jobs.
Nice.
So I'm the chief roboticist at NASA Ames out in California. And I'm the senior scientist for autonomous systems for NASA, agency-wide.
And I've read a little bit about how you kind of, you know, like even as a kid, was kind of interested in NASA. I don't know who wouldn't be. But how did you make that dream come true, more or less?
Well, it actually happened in grad school. I was actually starting to hunt around for jobs, and there was a professor who had a connection to a research group at NASA. Actually, NASA Ames in California, and he put me in contact, and, well, the rest is history.
Yeah. See, kids, you can actually network apart from Twitter. It's entirely possible.
Yeah, the old-fashioned way of actually meeting people.
Yeah, exactly. That's so. And how did you kind of rise to, like, tell us a little bit about, actually, the day-to-day of what you're doing now, because I heard a little bit of the conversation that you had yesterday here at Collision, but tell us kind of like what does a typical day look like?
Well, you know, my kids laugh because I often tell people that when I wake up and I can't wait to get into work, and that's like the first thing I want to do, even before breakfast, and they just think that's the funniest thing. But I really believe that. I think we spend so much of our adult lives at work that work should be someplace that you just can't wait to get to or that you can't wait to do because you're going to be spending a lot of your time doing that. And so for me, it's really great. I work with a really, really great group of people, very smart, very committed. Honestly, I think if you live in the Bay Area and you're not working at a startup company, if you're not working, for an extremely well-paying tech company, that means you're working someplace because you really care deeply about it. And I think that's certainly true across just about everybody that I work with at NASA Ames. People are there because they care deeply about either aeronautics or space. They really feel that the missions that we're working on are really unique, which I think they are. And for me, a basic day is going in and trying to help develop new technology for NASA's missions.
How much do you think that like the general public even gets the scope of what NASA does and what your group does?
I think that's something, frankly, even inside NASA is a little hard to grasp. I mean, NASA, back in the day, back in the 60s, everybody said, oh, yeah, NASA's going to the moon, and that's what NASA does. But NASA is a very large place. There are 10 centers spread across the United States. NASA Ames is just one of them, and we cover everything from aeronautics to Earth and space science to reentry systems, robotics, AI. It's a pretty broad spectrum of things. And I think that's a reflection of the fact that NASA, is the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. So we cover aviation, we cover space, and there's clearly science that connects both of those things.
Yeah, I mean, to me, one thing that's also interesting, and I don't know how much you think about this, but how there are all of these different commercial implementations and possibilities that are out there, like in the for-profit, maybe less altruistic sector, that they can be paying attention to the type of work that you're doing. And, I mean, how much do you feel that there's a lot of cross-pollination of ideas, especially being in Silicon Valley?
Yeah, well, I think one of the interesting things is that, as I said, NASA has 10 centers. Each one of them has a bit of a different culture, different focus. NASA Ames, which is in Silicon Valley, is very connected to, I think, what's going on in the tech sector. I mean, everybody who works at NASA Ames knows somebody or has a family member who works in tech. You know, we are local. I mean, we're basically next door to Google, and we used to be very close to Facebook. They moved, so a little bit further away. But, I mean, we're just, you know, surrounded by tech companies. And I think because of that, you know, there's more of a culture to be more entrepreneurial, to maybe look for more innovative, different ways of approaching technology development. You know, a few years ago, for example, we had a need to upgrade, you know, one of the free-flying robots on space station. It had been built basically a dozen years ago. This was a system called Spheres, designed, built at MIT, and it had as its main processor a TI digital signal processor, which was end of life, like, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years ago. You could only find spare parts if you could find them on eBay. But we wanted to make it more modern. We wanted to run more modern robotics code on it. And so we said, well, what we really need to do is we need to add better processor. We want high bandwidth, you know, wireless data communications. It'd be nice if it had a display and cameras and maybe built-in, you know, MEMS IMU. And people are sitting around a conference room and they're holding their smartphones. You can pretty much guess where we went. We said, hey, let's add a smartphone to it. And, you know, that is the kind of thinking that you think, oh, why would you take a smartphone and figure out how to modify it for space and attach it to a robot? But it worked out for us. We did some really good testing with that. This was back around 2011, I think it was. I think it's a really reflection of the fact that because we were in Silicon Valley, we thought, hey, we'll just go buy a smartphone. We'll hack it. We will remove a couple chips. We'll add something on top of it so that, you know, the screen won't break, those kinds of things. And that, to me, is just, I think, just a, you know, really good example of how, you know, you can be very, you know, sort of, technology innovative, Silicon Valley innovative, but still work at NASA.
And, well, yeah, no, for sure. I mean, I think that maybe, the which is great about your work, is I think it, you know, in some ways you can be a bit of a brand ambassador to say you think of NASA in a certain way. Well, actually, these are some of the things that we're doing.
Yep.
So one thing I want to ask you is, how do you, I mean, obviously I call the show Future Proof. I mean, how do you yourself in your own role get better at predicting the future on an ongoing basis? I'm not saying you're like calling yourself a futurist or anything, but you obviously have to figure out which technologies to invest in. And I think that that's a big part in predicting the future. So how do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a crystal ball. I'm sure a lot of people wish they had one as well. You know, one of my roles right now, as I said, is senior scientist for autonomous systems, which for NASA means that I run a team that's really trying to make an assessment of what is NASA doing right now in developing autonomy technology. What does NASA need for future missions? And, you know, what exists outside of NASA, whether that's in, you know, academic circles or in industry, and try to connect all those things together to come up with a strategic plan. And, you know, that's something that we're working very hard on right now. I mean, there's obviously a lot of development in industry and anything, you know, that has to do with, for example, drones or self-driving cars. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of, you know, what we might call autonomy tech sitting inside those. And the question is, you know, can we take those things and reuse them? Can we adapt them? Or do we need to invent something new? And so part of what I think we're trying to do is really make sure that we have our finger on the pulse of what's going on. That's one of the reasons why I'm here at Collision, to kind of see what's going on in the startup world. And a lot of the companies that are here are, you know, working in things that, you know, are tied to autonomy, or at least things that can feed into autonomy technology. And I think, you know, starting off with a real good assessment of what is the state of things within an organization like NASA and, you know, things that are just outside industry, academia, is very important as the first part of trying to predict where things are headed.
You know, it's interesting. I just thought about this, but I was walking around with a colleague yesterday, and I was looking at all the different early stage companies. And to me, what's interesting is almost, I kind of wonder, well, if you look year to year and you look at what companies are spending their time on, I would think, and I'm curious what you think about this, is that if you, like last year, I definitely saw more chatbot-focused yep. companies, okay? And I think if the market is not giving people feedback that this is the thing that you can build a profitable business around, then you're just going to see less of those next year.
Right,
so
right.
In some ways, one good way of predicting is just looking to actually see who's spending time developing what, and kind of like the wisdom of the crowd, the best ideas will surface.
Yeah, I think that is certainly important, and you know, I'm a big fan of you know, sites like Yelp, for example, if 10,000 people go to a restaurant and say it's 5 stars, you know, maybe they're right. And that is certainly a way, I think, of trying to identify trends in terms of what people believe is important and impactful. The danger, of course, is if you go with that, then you might miss out on that one, you know, sort of diamond in the rough that maybe people just didn't see, or they overlooked, or they didn't understand. And so I think we have a responsibility as well to try to, you know, cast a net broadly and not, you know, just sort of pass over things which maybe the herd doesn't really recognize. It. Oh, yeah, let's go along with that.
Yeah. Well, but also, I mean, I think that probably this is true for your work also, is timing is so important, because there was a company that I started working with in, like, 2003 called Mobileye, which is the autonomous vehicle company, collision detection, all that. And they wound up, I did the branding for them, and they wound up, I think, going public like a few years ago. They got acquired by Intel last year, and that was, is a good idea or not? I mean, in 2003, it was still a good idea because you know what would happen 15 years later,
right.
But a lot of people can't slog through that much time before they actually get a payday. And I mean, is that some of the benefit of working with, like, let's say a large entity such as NASA, where you can stay with an idea for longer? Or will, if you think of something, let's say, put it this way, like if you pilot a VR test and learn type of trial, and then you don't see the results you'd like in 18 months, would something like that get shut down just as it would in the private sector?
You know, I think NASA is in many respects no different than any large organization. I mean, there is internal R&D that we do sometimes manage to sustain for a long period of time. You know, the Robonaut project, for example, a humanoid robot, that project actually basically started, I think, like 18 or 19 years ago. And through a variety of different programs and working with different partners, you know, the people at Johnson Space Center continue to develop and mature that. And the most recent version of that, Robonaut 2, has been on the space station for several years. It's a good example of some long-term development. But at the same time, there are clearly other things that, you know, are not sustained over a long period of time, and maybe they just come back around.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that people may not be aware of is that much of the early research in virtual reality was done at NASA Ames back in the late 80s, early 90s.
I knew that, but I'm a nerd.
And it's funny because I think a lot of people who see VR today, they think, oh, my God, we just invented it. But, you know, this is the second, third, fourth round of this. And in between, very long period of time, just waiting for new technology, you know, advancements in displays or processors or just even graphics rendering chips.
You know, VR is a thing that I think a lot of people have been waiting to pop,
yeah.
You know, for a long time. And I think what's interesting is also, at least for commercial applications, augmented reality from a consumer standpoint, it kind of showed up seemingly out of nowhere to a lot of people and then actually got a little bit more of a foothold because people could see the practical applications or the technology. This is the joy of recording at the conference, is inevitably you hear what sounds like, 10 trolleys carrying food walking by. But, another thing that I think I wanted to ask you about, and just kind of like, this is going to bounce around a little bit. Definitely multiple perspectives applied to a particular problem can be a good thing. And obviously, you've got people that you collaborate with. How important is it for you to collaborate internally and externally to try to develop better technology, better pilot programs, and so on?
It's absolutely central. It's really core to what we do. One of my favorite expressions is that no one has a monopoly on good ideas. And collaboration is really the very best way to, you know, sort of surface new ideas and to validate, you know, ideas that someone might have but not quite sure about. And so at least, you know, in my world at NASA Ames and robotics, we collaborate very broadly with, you know, academia, with small business, with large business inside the United States and with international partners as well. I think as an example, every summer, you know, the group that I'm with at NASA Ames, the robotics group, has about 35 full-time people. But every summer, we usually have on the order of 25 to 30 students, and they come from all over the U.S. and overseas. They're from high school to grad school. And for us, that's a way of really making sure that we tap into a very broad, range of interests and knowledge and background, even just in the student community. And it's not like we say, hey, if you're not at MIT, then don't bother applying. For us, it's I can say that as an MIT alum, but but I mean the point is that that nobody has got a monopoly on good ideas, and just because you come from a school which is not maybe recognized as the world leader in space technology doesn't mean that you can't contribute.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is also one thing that I kind of noticed in my research is that the wisdom of the crowd is such that I think it's aggregate forecasts when you're trying to predict where anything is going are on average about 15% to 20% better if you're using wisdom of the crowd rather than just getting the best predictors, forecasters themselves. And to me, what that tells me is that when you have a little bit more of like a big tent mentality, you're able to get a lot of other big ideas in there that can help you succeed.
Yeah, well, and it's not just even the big ideas. It's just, as you were saying, maybe just different perspectives. You might be all working on the same thing, but someone has got a slightly different take on, where you're headed, or, maybe a slightly different view of a particular problem, and maybe that's the thing that just solves it.
Yeah, so, no, for sure. I think another thing I want to kind of ask you, like going back to your background and how, as people are looking to build a type of career that you've had and are having, not like it's at the end. You've got many.
I hope it's not done yet.
Yeah. So what's something that I think that you've learned along the way, like a brutal truth about innovation and how to bring innovation to market, using market broadly? What's a brutal truth about innovation that people don't necessarily talk about?
I think that one of the things that you don't learn in engineering school is the tremendous importance of communication. And communication is both in terms of being able to very crisply convey a message. I can't tell you how many times I've received email that just goes on forever and ever and ever. And you're like, hey, what's the main point? Can you give that to me right away? Nobody has time to read everything. But even if they did, they don't want to read through, 10,000 screenfuls of things. They want to know, hey, what are the key points up front? And so, being very efficient in your communications is one part of that. But the other part, too, is I think that, in engineering school, you're not really taught that you need to go out and really engage and communicate to people, whether that is through written language or spoken language, presenting, I think is a skill that's really undervalued in engineering domains. I mean, people, hey, I'm going to do a presentation on the work they did today. And they go up there and you can't hear them and you can't read their slides because they're written in like 5-point font and they've got, 20,000 words on one slide. And I think that, it's easy to kind of scoff and say, oh, hey, why do I need to communicate? I'm an engineer. I'm going to work with numbers, I'm going to write code, I don't need to communicate. But the reality is, and this is, like I said, the brutal truth is, communications is absolutely essential.
Yeah, I think that it is this, it's kind of like how we're all told when we're young, that fairness is a thing that inherently should exist in the world. Well, if your idea is the best, it doesn't necessarily win out unless you convince people and persuade them that your idea is the best, right? And I think that it kind of makes sense that there are a lot of engineers there's a stereotype for a reason where I think putting your head down and wanting to focus on the work and letting the work speak for itself, work is incapable of speaking unless you have a messenger telling the story.
Right. I think that's really interesting, the whole phrase, let the work speak for itself. I mean, that is driven by this notion that, the proof is in the pudding, that, you'll say, hey, look, here are my numbers. You should just be able to take this away and understand it. That actually is, I think, a core part of any good work. One of my advisors used to have this wonderful expression, and he says that that engineering, requires numbers, that, if you say, oh, yeah, this is better than something, you better have some numbers to back that up, I think that that's only part of it, though, because if you give somebody a page of numbers but don't tell them, what to look at, unless they happen to have your skills and your background and know how to interpret those numbers, they won't. And so you know, if you have done the work and, you know, you worked out the math or the numbers and you've got the results, you still need to communicate that.
I think in a lot of ways, one thing that, you know, that goes along with is the idea of, like, numbers don't lie. Well, it's not that the numbers lie, but people lie and people are capable of presenting the wrong number to you or a number out of context.
Right.
And then, that's the danger in numbers, is that the best thing about them is that they can empirically prove something in
sure.
a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And the bad thing is that you can look at them and feel very confident that you're drawing the wrong conclusion. I mean, how important are numbers in terms of quantifying the successes in your line of work?
Numbers are really important. I mean, we do calculations all the time. You know, you worry about whether or not a system is going to fail or not. And, well, you could say, maybe it's going to fail. But it's far better if you know it will fail under this condition when it reaches, you know, a certain amount of force or maybe it's going to be at a certain altitude or pressure or temperature. You know, those are the kind of things that, I mean, that's why we do engineering, because engineering is about the numbers. It's about the math. It's about, you know, trying to understand analytically, you know, when something's going to work or not.
Did you see, this is a random question, but the movie Zero Dark Thirty?
No, I didn't.
So there's this thing, I'm not going to spoil it for you, they catch Bin Laden.
Okay.
There's this thing where essentially the analyst, the main character, says something like, it's 100% certain. He's 100% certain that he's in there and you're going to catch him and whatever. And it just bothered me because these are people who are supposed to be dealing in percentages. And
right.
if somebody said 100%, well, that to me shows that you're not dealing with math and you're just dealing off of a gut feel. And
yeah.
a gut feel can be wrong
right.
and I think even misleading. How about biases? How about when you're trying to figure out, let's say if there's a particular technology that you have a particular affinity for and you're investigating it, how do you divorce yourself from your biases in order? Because there might be something that you find very personally gratifying, and then you investigate it and you say, well, there's not a real NASA-specific application right now. I mean, how do you, or how does one even acknowledge their biases in order to not allow those to affect what they do professionally?
I think that's certainly a really, you know, big challenging thing for any, you know, engineer or developer is, you know, you might have your own, you know, favorite way of doing something, but the question is that, you know, essential? Is it required? Is it ultimately the core thing that's important? You know, one of the ways that NASA has of trying to make those decisions is that if we're building a flight mission, you know, let's say we're going to build a rover to go to the moon or Mars, you know, we'll write out the key requirements. The system shall do X. The system shall do Y. And we use those as the ultimate arbiter of, well, do we need something? Is that going to really achieve that requirement? Will it make that possible? And if it doesn't, then you've got to ask yourself, do you really need that? You know, I also know that, you know, today, if you're a fan of, like, agile software development, you know, there's a concept of minimal viable product that
yeah.
is like the very bare minimum you need to push something out as a product. And I think that's a good thing because it says, hey, this is not the thing that's got all the bells and whistles, but this is the thing that I actually need. And at the end of the day, you know, if we're honest with ourselves, you know, why build something that's got, you know, way more features than anybody will ever care about? Because it just takes more time, it makes it more complex, it makes it more brittle, versus putting out, you know, just what you need and no more.
Yeah, and I think also what's interesting is it all depends what you're building, because you can, for software, sure, I mean, you just release a patch as soon as you get enough people using it,
right.
and they find the bugs, and the bugs are not fatal flaws.
Yeah.
If you're talking about some other type of system, I mean, a rocket
is a critical thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like you're going to release it out in the wild without having like a few little steps where you test and learn during the process, right?
Yeah.
How about, you know, like in terms of anything that you're working on now that you're able to talk about, the particular thing that you're, or it can even be a particular technology that you're most passionate in terms of exploring further? I know you kind of hinted at a few before.
Yeah, well, one of the things that is a real high priority for NASA right now is understanding how do we allow humans, you know, astronauts, to basically, you know, live and work in deep space. So one part of that is that we believe it's going to be necessary to have habitats of some type, whether this is in orbit or on the surface.
But the reality is that these are places that probably will not, you know, have people in all the time. You know, think about it. You know, unlike The Martian, the movie, which, you know, is absolutely a really fantastic story, I think, it's unlikely we're going to have, you know, people, you know, on the surface of Mars for very, very long periods of time, and basically have a continuously, you know, manned presence there. And so part of the question is, if you have these places where people need to live, and they're very expensive, and they have lots of unique, you know, irreplaceable equipment, how do you take care of it when people are not present? You know, we all have the experience of going to like a vacation home, or maybe you have an apartment or a house and you go away for a long vacation. You come back, and the first thing you find out is, you know, this is not quite the way I left it. You know, maybe the pipe froze. Maybe there was something that got in. You know, maybe there was, you know, an earthquake or something. But the reality is that means that something has changed while you were away, and the first thing you have to do oftentimes is to fix that. So if we have, you know, an orbiting space station, you know, NASA's currently looking at, you know, can we put a small space station that orbits the moon called the Gateway, or if you put a habitat on a planetary surface, say on Mars, what do you do when people aren't there? And I think, for me, part of the answer is that you need robots, because they're going to need to be able to fix things or even just move around and monitor things. Part of it is you need to make the system autonomous in some way so they can recognize, you know, hey, if nobody else is paying attention, I'm going to do something. I, the habitat, I'm going to do something before things get really out of control. And, you know, so I think the big challenge there is trying to understand, if you're going to accomplish that, what do you need to do that? There's so much development right now in, you know, smart home, smart office, smart appliance, smart grid, smart whatever you want to call it. And they all address different parts of that, but they probably don't address the whole problem.
Yeah, I mean, I think also, to me, one thing that I find very interesting is people define autonomy, I feel like, in different ways, because sure, something that's truly autonomous would arguably would not have any type of inputs that are needed. But I kind of feel, and this is maybe out of ignorance, that you need some type of connectivity to update something. When you find a way, for instance, to all these drones, let's say, that are in space, but you've got people down here that have to upload new instructions. I mean, it's not, I mean, it's semi-autonomous, but it still needs some type of human intervention every 8 weeks to update the code remotely or something like that, right?
Yeah, well, I think there are a couple of things there. One is autonomy is a relative term, okay? You're not just autonomous on some, you know, absolute scale. It's, you're always autonomous relative to something else. Maybe it's for a certain period of time. Maybe it's from a certain amount of interaction with somebody else. Maybe it's only within some limited scope. But it's always a relative term. The other thing, too, is that autonomy really is, at the basis, really just the ability to accomplish something independent of sort of external control, external influence. But then what's missing is sort of the dot, 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 subject to X, Y, and Z. You know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think of my kids as autonomous, and I think they probably would say that they're also autonomous, too. But clearly, you know, they change over time. I mean, the autonomy of a three-year-old is quite different from the autonomy of, like, an 18-year-old.
Which one do you have, three or 18?
Actually, mine are older, so...
Oh, nice. Okay. I yeah. can't wait to get to that point. Mine's four and a half, not so... Four and a half and one and a half, not so autonomous.
Yeah. so, you know, I've got a 15-year-old and a 19-year-old right now. So they are quite autonomous, but they didn't start that way. But even when they were younger, they were still autonomous, but, as I said, in a relative way.
Yeah.
Say, hey, okay, go to the kitchen and get this, and then you can kind of watch at a distance, and you can see that they're actually, you know, making it to the kitchen without getting distracted by something else. But now it's sort of like, hey, can you go to the store? And so it's a different level of autonomy. It's under different constraints. It's under different, you know, assumptions of what they're capable of.
But, you know, speaking of autonomy and also going to the store, so I'm going to awkward transition, but there are a lot of people concerned about their ability to, let's say, go to the store in the future because they're worried about the robots, they're taking our jobs, that whole entire thing. And I've heard both sides of this, and I kind of err on the side of, well, you know, people will move to more value-added intellectual jobs as opposed to doing random semi-dangerous things that autonomy can take care of. So that's my point of view, but what do you think about that? I know that, and again, you almost have to divorce your biases from this because nobody wants to say, yeah, autonomy is going to, there are going to be all these growing pains, but how do you think that that'll impact society writ large?
You know, I view it as just the latest version of that age-old question of, oh, we have new technology, how does that change things? You know, I mean, how many horse and buggy, you know, drivers do we have around today? Not a whole lot. I mean, a few in amusement parks and stuff like that, but, you know, they replaced by the automobile. People, you know, we don't ride horses in general, except for recreation. We drive cars now. Maybe in a few years, we won't even be driving cars. And the thing is that I think that the argument that, oh, you know, the coming robot revolution is going to, you know, free people from drudgery and they can go off and do more intellectual tasks, that's not really the right way of thinking about it, I don't think. I mean, I think, sure, some people will do that, but I think in general what that means is that it's just changing what we think of as work that we might be doing. Maybe, you know, you're going to be freed up from having to, I don't know, clean the floor or vacuum the floor. In fact, people would say, well, that's why you have, you know, a Roomba right now. You know, have a robot to vacuum your floor for you. And therefore, you have all this other time to do things other than that. Well, I don't know how many people out there are saying, yeah, today, my goal in life today is to go vacuum the floor. So, you know, the idea that you're just freed up to do other things, maybe that wasn't so much a big thing, you know?
You know, there was like this NPR story about, and I don't know if it was based off of some other idea, but there was about the guy who has like the last job in the world, and the one job is a guy, he basically has to keep all of the robots running in the whole world by hitting a button or some basic thing, and everybody else goes off and has fun. And I think, you know, it kind of goes to the larger point that do humans want to do something, want to be productive?
Right.
And I think, you know, I just kind of think that naturally we don't want to sit around and we do go crazy. And if not, that's the thing that separates us from our, you know, ancestors and whatever humans came from, is the fact that we are just, you know, we inherently go stir crazy and invent things.
Yeah.
So of course, that's where our bias is going to be.
Yeah, I heard this. I heard the story. I don't remember what station it was on just last week, and the person who was talking pointed out that through basically like 99% of human existence, on the Earth, people were basically living below what we today would consider to be the poverty level. You know, we spent all of our time just trying to figure out how you're going to stay alive for the next day, where are you going to find food. And it's really only been the past, you know, 300 or so years because of, you know, the cultures we've developed, but also really, I think, strongly driven by the technology that we've developed, that people don't have to do those things all the time. And it's not to say that everybody around the world, you know, is free from that. But certainly, you know, here in the United States and in much of the Western world, you know, I think a lot of people now can do things other than, hey, I'm going to go outside and hunt something because I'm hungry tonight.
Yeah.
And so maybe in the future, you know, through robots and other technology, that will become more general. And maybe even for us today, we're going to have a different kind of life.
So I know I have to let you go in a minute. I just want to ask you, if the average everyday consumer is interested in kind of following the type of work that you do, is there a particular place, obviously just don't just go to NASA.gov, but is there a particular vehicle you recommend they check you guys out and follow your progress
on? Oh, yeah, that's easy. Social media. NASA, more than any other government agency, is deeply connected in social media. You know, we have an extremely large following on Twitter. The agency has been trying to use other platforms as well. I had the privilege recently of being part of a NASA experiment of using Twitch. You'd be kind of surprised to think, oh, what's NASA using Twitch for? Well, because we want to live stream and have interactive sessions with people. So a couple months ago, we did I think it was a 4-episode pilot of NASA in Silicon Valley Live. It was a Twitch stream show, and there was a lot of interactive chatting back and forth with people online asking questions as we were talking about everything from small satellites to space robots. And I think, you know, I really give a lot of credit to the people in public affairs and outreach at NASA that really believe that the right way to connect with people in a very large scale, easy, accessible way is through the use of social media. And so, you know, NASA's a big supporter of social media. If you want to connect with the agency, pick your favorite media social media platform, and I guarantee you there's a NASA connection there.
And, you know, going full circle, I think what's great about what you guys do is by showing people the fact that this work is happening, you attract those people who might not go to MIT, but also realize, wait a minute, there's some really interesting things happening,
yep.
and they can study, and they know that this is a career path for them. And I feel like if we can get those type of data engineers and scientists coming up through the ranks, then we're just going to have a pretty bright future as a country.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, well, thank you so much, Terry.
My
pleasure. I know you got to go, but I really appreciate the time.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
And thank you so much, Terry, for that great conversation. And thank you all for listening. We really appreciate your time. And we appreciate even more if you can rate us and review us on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher and wherever you get your podcast listening habit taken care of. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.